This is Mary Lee reading BBC News on Monday, April 6th. Emergency jabs after 100 children die of suspected measles in a month in Bangladesh by Ko Ui in BBC Bangla. Bangladesh has launched an emergency vaccination campaign after a fast-spreading measles outbreak is suspected of killing more than 100 people, mostly children, in what may be the country's most lethal wave of the disease in recent history. The campaign, which began on Sunday, comes amid more than 7,500 suspected measles cases since March 15th, according to Health Ministry data. More than 900 of these cases have been confirmed, a sharp increase from 2025 when just 125 measles cases were recorded over the entire year, local media report. While Bangladesh has long vaccinated children against the highly contagious disease, the recent outbreak has exposed gaps in its program, raising concern. Vaccines are foundational to child survival, Rana Flowers, the UNICEF representative in Bangladesh, said in a statement on Sunday, adding that the current measles outbreak was putting thousands of children, especially the youngest and most vulnerable, at serious risk. Why is there a spike in measles in Bangladesh? In Bangladesh, a nation of 170 million people, routine measles vaccines are given to children as young as 9 months old. But Sharia Sajjad, deputy director of the health department, told BBC Bangla that about one-third of those infected in the recent outbreak were under 9 months old. The infections of these young infants who are not yet eligible for routine vaccination are especially alarming, said Flowers from UNICEF. On top of routine vaccinations, Bangladesh conducts special measles vaccination campaigns every 4 years. But these campaigns haven't gone according to plan. There have been no special measles vaccination campaigns since 2020, first because of COVID, then because of the political situation, Sajjad told BBC Bangla. Bangladesh experienced political upheaval in 2024 when massive anti-government protests toppled its long-ruling leader, Sheikh Hasina. An interim government took over after Hasina's ousting, and only in February this year did the country elect a new government. A measles vaccination campaign was supposed to be held in April this year, but it did not happen, Sajjad said. A health official said procurement issues had led to a shortage of vaccines, including for measles, the Daily Star reported. Many in Bangladesh have blamed the vaccine shortages on the former interim government, which oversaw a new vaccine procurement system. But measles resurgences are typically the result of these accumulated gaps rather than a single factor, UNICEF said in its statement. Bangladesh has a strong history of high immunization coverage, but even small disruptions can lead to the gradual accumulation of immunity gaps over time. What is Bangladesh doing about it? Along with international partners like UNICEF and the World Health Organization, Bangladesh has launched an emergency vaccination campaign for measles and rubella, a milder disease with similar symptoms to measles. This campaign, which started on Sunday, will be rolled out across 30 Upazilas, sub-districts in Bangladesh, and targets more than 1.2 million children between 6 months and 5 years old. The campaign will prioritize children who have missed routine immunization and are most vulnerable to severe illness and complications, according to UNICEF. There will also be a particular focus on Dhaka, the densely populated capital, and Cox's Bazar, home to crowded Rohingya refugee camps, UNICEF said. Besides the vaccination drive, health authorities are also publishing infographics that teach people how to identify and prevent measles. What is measles? Measles is a highly contagious airborne disease which can lead to severe complication and death. Common symptoms include high fever, sore, red, and watery eyes, coughing, sneezing. In 2024, an estimated 95,000 people were killed by measles around the world, most of them children under 5 years old, according to the World Health Organization. Measles can be prevented through vaccination, but according to the WHO, 95% of the population has to be vaccinated in order to stop the disease from spreading. Are measles cases rising around the world? Over the past two decades, the number of global measles cases and deaths resulting from the disease have fallen sharply. There were 11 million cases of measles worldwide in 2024, a significant decrease from 38 million in 2000, according to the WHO. But the organization has warned about a resurgence in parts of the world as vaccination rates fall. In 2024 and 2025, the world saw the highest number of measles outbreaks in more than 20 years, according to medical journal The Lancet. Causes of measles have risen in some countries in Asia and Africa, as well as Europe, the U.S., and the U.K., where there is growing skepticism against vaccines, especially after the pandemic. In February, an outbreak of measles in some schools in North London prompted health authorities to remind parents to vaccinate their children. Why the Strait of Hormuz matters so much in the Iran war. Gavin Butler, Toby Mann, Patrick Johnson, and BBC Persian. Iran has effectively blocked the Strait of Hormuz, one of the world's busiest oil shipping channels, since the U.S. and Israel attacked the country on February 28th. About 20% of the world's oil and liquefied natural gas usually passes through the strait, and the war has sent global fuel prices soaring. What and where is the Strait of Hormuz? Bounded to the north by Iran and to the south by Oman and the United Arab Emirates, the corridor, only about 50 kilometers, 31 miles, wide at its entrance and exit, and about 33 kilometers wide at its narrowest point, connects the Gulf with the Arabian Sea. The strait is deep enough for the world's biggest crude oil tankers and is used by major Middle Eastern oil and LNG producers as well as their customers. In 2025, about 20 million barrels of oil and oil products passed through the Strait of Hormuz per day, according to estimates from the U.S. Energy Information Administration. That is nearly $600 billion worth of energy trade per year. The oil comes not only from Iran, but other Gulf states such as Iraq, Kuwait, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. About 20% of global LNG is also shipped through the strait, mostly from Qatar. In 2024, it exported about 9.3 billion cubic feet per day of LNG through the strait, and the UAE about 0.7 BCF/D. LNG is gas turned into liquid, which takes up 600 times less space for transport, which is then turned back into gas at its destination to be used for heating, cooking, and power. Hormuz is also a crucial route for exports of fertilizer from the Middle East, where natural gas is used heavily in the production process. About one-third of the world's fertilizer trade normally passes through the strait. And going in the opposite direction, the strait is a vital chain for imports to the Middle East, including food, medicines, and technological supplies. What is the impact of closing the strait, and how is Iran effectively blocking it? About 3,000 ships usually sail through the strait each month, but this has dramatically decreased recently, with Iran threatening to attack tankers and other ships. A mix of threats, including drones, missiles, fast attack boats, and potentially mines, presents a serious challenge to boats seeking to travel through the strait. By March 20th, the BBC had been able to verify 20 attacks on commercial vessels off the Iranian coast. As of April 2nd, nonprofit United Against Nuclear Iran said there had been at least 24 commercial vessels hit, plus three near misses. You can be attacked and you can't get insurance, or it is extremely expensive, so you have to wait until the security situation is better. Arne Lohmann Rasmussen, chief analyst at Global Risk Management, a provider of energy market insights, told CBS News, the BBC's U.S. partner. While there is no physical blockade, threats from the Iranians, plus drone and missile attacks, mean tankers are not going through the strait. Energy prices are volatile and remain well above levels before the conflict. Gulf countries, including Iran, rely heavily on energy exports for their income. A blockade of the strait has also hit Asia hard, with China alone estimated to buy around 90% of the oil that Iran exports to the global market. Because China uses that oil to make products it then exports to other countries, higher oil prices could also mean higher prices for consumers around the world. In Asia, the fuel crisis is impacting daily life. Governments have ordered employees to work from home. cut the working week, declared national holidays, and closed universities early in order to conserve their supplies. In Africa, South Sudan and Mauritius have both announced measures restricting electricity consumption. In Europe, Slovenia became the first EU member state to implement fuel rationing. How does Iran control the strait? United Nations rules allow countries to exercise control of territorial seas up to 12 nautical miles from their coastline. At the narrowest point, the Strait of Hormuz and its shipping lanes lie entirely with Iran and Oman's territorial waters. According to experts, one of the most effective ways for Iran to restrict the strait militarily would be to lay mines using fast attack boats and submarines. Iran's fast boats are often armed with anti-ship missiles. How is the U.S. trying to reopen the strait? So far, the U.S. has not deployed any warships to the strait, confining its military response to air attacks on Iran, including its navy. On March 18th, for instance, the U.S. military reported bombing Iranian anti-ship cruise missiles sites along the strait. Trump called for other countries, including both U.S. allies and China, to help secure Hormuz by sending warships, met with little enthusiasm. He then said the U.S. did not actually need their help. The U.S. has previously used its military might to reestablish the flow of maritime traffic through the strait. By the late 1980s, during the eight-year Iran-Iraq War, strikes on oil facilities escalated into a tanker war that saw both countries attacking neutral ships to exert economic pressure. Kuwaiti tankers carrying Iraqi oil were especially vulnerable, eventually American warships began escorting them through the Gulf in what became one of the largest naval surface warfare operations since World War II, according to the U.S. Naval Institute. Are ships still getting through? In a message posted by its mission to the United Nations, on March 24th, Iran said it would allow non-hostile vessels to pass through the Strait of Hormuz, provided they coordinate with the competent Iranian authorities. About 100 ships passed through the Strait of Hormuz between 1st of March and 20th of March. BBC Verify analysis showed earlier this month. On April 3rd, a French container ship, three Oman-linked tankers, and a Japanese gas carrier crossed the strait. The French ship belonged to Maritime Transport Group, CMA-CGM, and was reportedly the first Western vessel to pass through the strait. Daily traffic is down about 95% since the Iran war began on 28th of February, according to the BBC Verify analysis. About a third of the recent crossings were made by ships with connections to Iran. Between the 1st and the 15th of March, a total of 11 China-linked vessels transited through the strait, the U.S. business news site CNBC reported on March 18th. On March 31st, Beijing expressed gratitude after three of its ships passed through the strait, including two container ships on Monday belonging to state-owned shipping giant Costco. At least eight Indian-flagged LPG carriers have traversed the Strait of Hormuz. Can energy exporters avoid Hormuz? The persistent threat of closure has, over the years, prompted oil-exporting countries in the Gulf region to develop overland routes. Saudi Arabia operates the 1,200-kilometer-long east-west crude oil pipeline, capable of transporting up to 5 million barrels of crude oil per day, according to the U.S. government. In the past, it has also temporarily repurposed a natural gas pipeline to carry crude oil. Key pipelines that bypass the Strait of Hormuz: East-West Pipeline and Habshan-Fujairah Pipeline. The UAE has connected its inland oil fields to the port of Fujairah on the Gulf of Oman via a pipeline with a daily capacity of at least 1.5 million barrels. Oil could be diverted along the alternate infrastructure to bypass Hormuz, but Reuters reports that would lead to a drop in supply of 8 to 10 million barrels per day. In addition, oil loading at Fujairah has been disrupted by drone attacks. Oil prices choppy after expletive-laden Trump threat to Iran, by Osman Chia. Oil prices saw choppy trading on Monday after U.S. President Donald Trump threatened to destroy critical infrastructure in Iran unless it allows ships to cross the Strait of Hormuz. In an expletive-laden social media post on Sunday, Trump said the U.S. would attack power plants and bridges unless the crucial waterway is open by late Tuesday, U.S. time. Brent crude rose above $110 a barrel before those gains eased after a report of U.S.-Iran talks over a potential ceasefire. Oil and gas shipments from the Middle East have been severely disrupted as Tehran threatens to attack vessels that try to use the strait in retaliation for U.S. and Israeli airstrikes since 28th of February. News website Axios reported that the U.S., Iran, and a group of regional mediators are discussing the terms of a potential 45-day ceasefire that could lead to a permanent end to the conflict, citing U.S., Israeli, and regional sources. A White House source told the BBC that this was one of many ideas, and Trump has not signed off on it. Operation Epic Fury continues. The source added that Trump will speak more at a press conference at 1300 local time, or 1800 British Standard Time. In the hours following the Axios report, the global benchmark oil price fell from $110 a barrel to around $107. Oil prices will remain volatile and swing with each headline of the war's escalation and easing, said Sushant Gupta from consultancy Wood Mackenzie. The focus remains on whether energy shipments from the Gulf can resume to ease the supply shortage that has impacted countries around the world, he said. Disruption to shipping in the narrow waterway, through which a fifth of the world's energy shipments usually passes, has pushed up the price of energy around the world and raised concerns about higher inflation globally. Oil prices rose above $100 a barrel last week after Trump intensified threats against Iran, warning that U.S. airstrikes over the next weeks could send the country back to the Stone Ages. Iranian attacks on oil facilities in the Gulf continued over the weekend. Tehran claimed responsibility on Sunday for a wave of strikes on petrochemical plants in Kuwait, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates. On Monday, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps warned that its attacks against U.S. economic interests would be intensified if civilian infrastructure in its country continues to be targeted. On Sunday, OPEC Plus Minus, which includes major oil-producing members of the Organization of the Petroleum-Exporting Countries like Saudi Arabia and Russia, agreed a small increase to crude output in May. But the 206,000 barrels a day production hike will largely exist on paper only, as several of the group's key members are unable to increase output due to the conflict. Trump has postponed several deadlines for Iran to remove its threats against ships using the strait, but repeated his demands in a strongly worded Truth Social post. The paragraph below contains very strong language. Trump wrote on Sunday, quote, "Tuesday will be power plant day and bridge day all wrapped up in one in Iran. There will be nothing like it. Open the fucking strait, you crazy bastards, or you'll be living in hell. Just watch. Praise be to Allah, President Donald J. Trump." A few hours later, in a post on the same platform, he said, "Tuesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time." Trump told Fox News there was a good chance an agreement would be reached on Monday, but said he was considering blowing everything up and taking over the oil if deal was not reached soon. Senior Iranian military officer General Ali Abdollahi Aliabadi dismissed an earlier Trump deadline, calling it helpless, nervous, unbalanced, and stupid, adding that the gates of hell will open for the U.S. leader. The 40 Minutes When the Artemis Crew Loses Contact with the Earth by Rebecca Morell, Allison Francis, and Kevin Church. No one will have been further from home than the Artemis astronauts. But as the Earth shrinks ever smaller in their rearview mirror, they've had a constant connection with Mission Control in Houston, Texas. The calm words from the NASA team have given the crew a comforting link with home. That link is about to be lost. As the astronauts pass behind the moon at about 2347 or 1847 Eastern Daylight Time on Monday, the radio and laser signals that allow the back-and-forth communication between the spacecraft and Earth will be blocked by the moon itself. For about 40 minutes, the four astronauts will be alone, each with their own thoughts and feelings, traveling through the darkness of space, a profound moment of solitude and silence. Artemis pilot Victor Glover told us he hopes the world will use the time to come together. When we're behind the moon, out of contact with everybody, Let's take that as an opportunity, he told BBC News before the mission. Let's pray, hope, send your good thoughts and feelings that we get it back in contact with the crew. More than 50 years ago, the Apollo astronauts also experienced the isolation brought by a loss of signal during their missions to the moon. Perhaps none more so than Apollo 11's Michael Collins. In 1969, while Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin made history taking the first steps on the lunar surface, Collins was alone in the command module orbiting the moon. As his craft passed behind the far side, contact with the pair on the lunar surface, as well as with mission control, vanished for 48 minutes. He described the experience in his 1974 memoir, Carrying the Fire, saying he felt truly alone and isolated from any known life, but that he did not feel fear or loneliness. In later interviews, he described the peace and tranquility brought by the radio silence, saying it offered a break from the constant requests from mission control. More on Artemis II. Back on Earth, the blackout will be a tense time for those with the job of maintaining contact with the spacecraft. At the Goon Hilly Earth Station in Cornwall, in the southwest of England, a huge antenna has been collecting signals from the Orion capsule, carefully pinpointing its position throughout its journey and feeding this information back to NASA headquarters. Matt Cosby, Goon Hilly's chief technology officer, told the BBC, "This is the first time we're tracking a spacecraft with humans on it. We're going to get slightly nervous as it goes behind the moon, and then we'll be very excited when we see it again because we know that they're all safe. But the hope is these dropouts in communications could soon become a thing of the past, and Cosby says that will be essential as NASA and other space agencies around the world begin to build a moon base and ramp up further exploration. For a sustainable presence on the moon, you need the full comms. You need the full 24 hours a day, even on the far side, because the far side will want to be explored as well," he said. Programs like the European Space Agency's Moonlight are planning to launch a network of satellites around the moon to provide continuous and reliable communication coverage in the future. For the Artemis astronauts, their time without contact with the Earth will allow them to devote all of their attention to the moon. They'll spend the blackout dedicated to lunar observation, taking images, studying the moon's geology, and simply gazing at its splendor. When they emerge from the moon's shadow and that signal is reestablished, the world will breathe a collective sigh of relief. And the history-making astronauts will be able to share their incredible views with everyone back home. How China fell for a lobster. What an AI assistant tells us about Beijing's ambition. By Fan Wang and Yan Chen. "Are you a lobster?" is the first question Wang had for the BBC. He had been so consumed recently by the AI assistant OpenClaw, which in China has earned the name Lobster, that he wondered if he was talking to AI rather than a journalist. After being assured he was not, the young IT engineer explained how he had fallen deep into AI and especially OpenClaw. Driven by encouragement from the very top of China's leadership, the world's second biggest economy has embraced artificial intelligence, sparking both curiosity and concern. OpenClaw, built by Austrian developer Peter Steinberger, is an example of how this is playing out. Because it is built on open-source data and tech, the code is available to those who want to customize it to work with Chinese AI models. And that is a huge advantage because Western models such as ChatGPT and Claude are not accessible in China. So OpenClaw stirred up a frenzy as more people experimented with its code. Wang was one of them. He did not want to share his full name because of his side gig running an online shop selling digital gadgets on TikTok, which is banned in China. When he first saw what his lobster, built on OpenClaw's code and altered for his use, could do, he said he was stunned. Uploading products to the TikTok shop is a grind. Adding images, writing titles and descriptions, setting prices and discounts, signing up for campaigns, and messaging influencers. Usually he can manage about a dozen listings a day. His lobster, which he was still testing, can do up to 200 in just 2 minutes, he claimed. "It is scary but also exciting. My lobster is better than I am at this. It writes better and can instantly compare my prices with every competitor, something I would never have time to do." OpenClaw had already exploded in the global tech community. NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang called it the next ChatGPT, and its developer Steinberger recently joined OpenAI. But the enthusiasm that turned OpenClaw into something trendy was uniquely Chinese, said Wendy Chang from the Merix think tank. Wang called OpenClaw the AI era's answer for ordinary people. Chinese tech giants seemed to agree because they were releasing apps built on OpenClaw. From the southern tech hub of Shenzhen to the capital of Beijing, hundreds of people from secondary school students to retirees were lining up outside the headquarters of Tencent and Baidu for free customized versions. Many were curious to find out more about the lobsters. Some users online said they used them to invest in stocks, claiming their lobsters analyzed the best times to buy and sell, and even did the deed despite the risk of costly errors. Others said the tools were great for multitasking and saving time. Famous comedian and author Lee Dan told millions of his followers on Douyin that he was so immersed in OpenClaw that he talked to his lobster in his dreams. Fu Cheng, chief executive of Cheetah Mobile, relentlessly shared how he raised his lobster on social media, a phrase users adopt to describe training the assistant for the requirements. China's AI moment has been in the making for some time. When the Chinese app DeepSeek burst onto the AI scene early last year, it seemed to catch a lot of people by surprise. It was also an open-source platform developed by homegrown engineers from elite Chinese universities, and it came on the back of years of investments in developing crucial technology, including AI, which has only continued in the wake of DeepSeek's success. What DeepSeek showed was that the Chinese entrepreneurial appetite for seeking out opportunities in research and innovation, despite curbs on the import of advanced tech. And it also proved how eagerly people were willing to adopt open-source platforms. So the stage was set for OpenClaw. Its popularity did not escape the Chinese government. Several counties and cities provided incentives to encourage entrepreneurs to apply OpenClaw in their businesses. The eastern city of Wuxi offered up to 5 million yuan, or $726,000, for manufacturing-related applications such as robots. Everyone in China knows that the government sets the pace, and the government tells you where the opportunities are, said Wei Ma, founder of the Tech Buzz China newsletter. It's practical for most people. That's probably a better plan, to just follow the government directive than to really try to figure it out on your own. Once Beijing signals its priorities, the market follows. In the past few years, tech companies, large and small, have rushed into the AI race, supported by subsidized office space, cash rewards, and loans. From manufacturing to transport, healthcare to household electronics, companies are seeking to integrate AI into their products and operations. That's the spirit of AI Plus, Chang says, referring to China's national strategy to integrate AI across industries. Take AI, apply it everywhere. The competition is fierce. In what Chinese media have dubbed the 100 model war, with more than 100 AI models have emerged since 2023, with only 10 still in contention. Chinese AI platforms still lag behind Western competitors, experts say, though the gap is narrowing. That is why, for Chinese officials, promoting OpenClaw is a strategic move, according to Jenny Yao. But much of the initial hype has cooled as users begin to reckon with the costs involved. Interacting with the agent requires spending tokens as well as security concerns. Last month, Beijing's cybersecurity authorities warned of serious risks linked to improperly installing and using OpenClaw. A growing number of government agencies have since banned staff from installing the tool. Soon, the trend shifted from offering to install the service to removing it. Such contradiction is not unusual in China's top-down system, Ma says. Local governments often compete for approval from Beijing by ushering in tools that align with what the Communist Party leadership wants, and then pedal back as challenges arise. It's disorder with control, Ma says, adding that the Beijing's intervention doesn't necessarily signal discouragement. For one, AI startups could address a major challenge, youth unemployment rate of more than 16%. Many government incentives tied to OpenClaw, some with subsidies of up to 10 million yuan, mention one-person companies or startups run by an individual with the help of AI. Who's the most likely to build a one-person company? Probably young people who face a tough job market, Zhao says. In the year And the fear of falling behind is acute in China, given the intense competition over jobs. Some say that in 2026, if you don't raise lobsters, you've already lost at the starting line, reads a commentary published by state newspaper People's Daily. It is genuinely terrifying, said Jason, an IT programmer whose team is only hiring those who have experience using AI tools. It's mostly people leaving with very few new hires coming in. Wang agrees that it's a scary time. Everyone could be replaced, though he doesn't seem overly worried himself. I probably won't need to work, and this could become my full-time job, he said, referring to his TikTok business. What if the lobsters can run their own shops, squeezing him out? I'll use AI to find another business. Really feeling the love, Savannah Guthrie returns to NBC as Search for Mother goes on, by Madeline Halpert. U.S. television presenter Savannah Guthrie has returned to NBC's Today Show, telling her co-anchors it was good to be back as the search for her mother continues. It was her first appearance in the studio since January 30th, 2 days before her 84-year-old mother Nancy was reported missing. Her co-anchors noted on Monday that many fans were standing outside the studios on a chilly New York morning, carrying signs welcoming Guthrie back. "I'm really feeling the love," she said in response. Investigators believe Nancy Guthrie, who was last seen on January 31st, was taken against her will from her home near Tucson, Arizona, but they have not shared a possible motive or arrested a suspect. Before giving his typical weather report, NBC forecaster Al Roker blew her a kiss and said, "It's good to see you, my dear." Guthrie carried on with the news as usual, telling viewers about the Artemis Moon mission and the National Collegiate Athletic Association men's basketball tournament finals. "Last month," she said, "it was part of my purpose right now to return to work," although she was unsure if she would still be able to do it. On Easter Sunday, Savannah Guthrie reaffirmed her Christian faith in an Easter video message from a church in New York. "I still believe, and so I say with conviction, Happy Easter," she said in her closing message at the end of the Easter Sunday service at Good Shepherd, New York. The NBC presenter, one of the most recognizable figures on morning television in the U.S., had temporarily stepped away from her anchoring duties after her mother's disappearance. She also stood down from NBC's coverage of the Winter Olympics. In an interview last month with Today, she said, "I can't not come back. This is my family." She also raised the possibility that her own fame may have been behind her mother's disappearance, saying that that thought was too much to bear. Nancy Guthrie vanished without her medicines. She was dropped off at her home by relatives on the evening of January 31st and then failed to show up at a friend's house to watch a virtual Sunday service the following morning. The family announced in February a $1 million reward for information leading to her return. Sheriff in Nancy Guthrie case believes they know kidnapper's motive, by Brandon Drennan. The sheriff investigating the kidnapping of Nancy Guthrie, mother of U.S. TV presenter Savannah Guthrie, says authorities believe they have a motive, but have not identified a suspect. Bena County Sheriff Chris Nanos told NBC News that "we believe we know why he did this. He said authorities believe it was targeted, but they were not 100% sure of that. Guthrie has been missing since she was taken from her home in Tucson, Arizona on February 1st. A nationwide search has unveiled certain clues, including DNA evidence and ransom notes, but no suspect has been identified. Nanos declined to elaborate on the suspected motive, as he said it could compromise the integrity of the ongoing investigation to do so. The sheriff did warn there was absolutely a chance that the unknown suspect, who kidnapped Guthrie 41 days ago, could strike again. "It'd be silly to tell people, yeah, don't worry about it, you're not his target," Nanos said in Thursday's NBC News interview. "Don't think for a minute that because it happened to the Guthrie family, you're safe." Nanos warned residents in Guthrie's affluent Catalina Foothills neighborhood to keep your wits about you. Savannah Guthrie has posted multiple videos on social media making direct appeals to her mother's captor and is offering $1 million for information that leads to her return. "She may be lost, she may already be gone," Savannah said in a video shared in February. There have been arrests and detainments in the case, but they have not led officials to find the actual suspect. A California man arrested on suspicion of sending fake ransom notes is facing federal charges, but does not seem to be involved in Nancy's disappearance. A delivery man was also detained for questioning, but he was released shortly after he was cleared by authorities. So far, the lone glimpse officials have of the suspect is of a masked man whose image was captured on the doorbell camera outside Nancy Guthrie's home. Young gray whale dies after swimming upriver in Washington State, by Adila Suleiman. A young gray whale has been found dead after swimming 20 miles inland up a river in Washington State, a local scientific research group said, pointing to hunger as a possible cause. We are saddened to confirm that the whale seen in the Willapa River over the past few days is deceased, the Cascadia Research Collective said in an update on Facebook on Saturday. It said the group was evaluating the safety of the location to carry out an examination. The juvenile whale, affectionately dubbed Willapa Willie by locals, was first spotted last Wednesday in the North Fork of the river, about 145 miles southwest of Seattle, the Marine Mammal Research Group said. The whale, although thin, was behaving normally, the group said at the time, with no sign of injuries. Its teams had hoped the whale would find its own way out of the river, but it failed to do so. Gray whales undertake long springtime migrations north up the Pacific coast to feed in the Arctic, using up their nutritional reserves along the way. John Kalambokidis, a research biologist with the Cascadia Research Collective, told the Associated Press, "When that happens, you often see gray whales in a more desperate search for new areas to feed," he added. "That's the most likely context for this whale." Gray whales in the eastern part of the Pacific Ocean have faced reduced food availability in the northern Bering and Chukchi seas off Alaska's coast in recent years, Kalambokidis said. Gray whales are facing a major crisis, and the heart of it does seem to be feeding on their prey in the Arctic, he added. Gray whales are a focus of whale watching and ecotourism along the west coast of North America. It can grow to about 15 meters long and weigh approximately 40,000 kilograms, or 90,000 pounds, according to the National Marine Fisheries Service in the United States. They face threats from vessel strikes to entanglement in fishing gear on their long migration routes. They also tend to travel alone. Long-term bonds between individuals are thought to be rare, it said. Two adult gray whales washed up dead in the nearby ocean shores area earlier in April. Cascadia Research Collective said, "These 42-foot adults, one male and one female, were both malnourished. The male also had significant trauma to the head, consistent with ship strike," it added. The most recent count from winter 2025 reveals a continuing decline in the population of the species, according to NOAA Fisheries, which estimated there were about 13,000, the lowest count since the 1970s. In sports, Arsenal's Rice and Gabriel train before Lisbon trip, by Harry Poole. Arsenal's Declan Rice and Gabriel have trained before Tuesday's Champions League quarterfinal with Sporting. Midfielder Rice, 27, left the England squad following a medical assessment during March's international break and missed Saturday's FA Cup quarterfinal loss to Southampton. Brazil defender Gabriel, meanwhile, was forced off with a knee issue after taking a knock during the defeat on the South Coast. Both players were involved in first-team training at the club's London Colney base on Monday before Mikel Arteta's side traveled to Lisbon for the first leg. Belgian winger Leandro Trossard also returned to training, but Bukayo Saka was not involved after he also left the England camp early. Premier League leaders Arsenal will seek to avoid a third straight defeat on Tuesday after the FA Cup exit followed their Carabao Cup final defeat by Manchester City. They are 9 points clear of second-placed City as they chase a First League title since 2003 to 2004 and return to pursuing that target at home to Bournemouth on Saturday. Boss Arteta and goalkeeper David Raya are scheduled to speak with the media in Portugal later on Monday. Ranking Football's Greatest One Club Men, by Alex Bisouth. Every year at San Mimes, the iconic home of Athletic Club in Balboa, local fans pause to recognize and celebrate players not from their own club, but those who share a unique value with the Basque outfit, loyalty. Athletic Club, famous for only fielding players born or raised in the region, introduced the One Club Award in 2015, honoring those who dedicated their entire professional career to a single team. We wanted to create an award that recognized most kids' growing up dream of playing for one club, explains Dan Perry from the La Liga's side's communications department. On the other side, we wanted to show, despite all the big money transfers in modern day football, there are top players all over the world who want to become one club players. It's an individual award, but it's also an award that celebrates the union between the football team, fans, and the player. Keeping those values in mind, then, this week I'm ranking football's top 10 one-club men. You can have your say below, too. Spending your entire career with one club is a curious phenomenon. In 20-plus years at the top, you're likely to outlast several managers. And how often do the player or club's paths take different trajectories? It's not solely the player's decision to stay, either. The club has to want them. And you have to forge a strong bond with the fans. From Tony Hibbert to Ledley King and even aptly named Celtic stalwart Paul McStay, many become cult heroes or club legends. Athletic club could field teams of one-club players, past and present, but they only give the award to retired players from other clubs. We look for players we feel embody the values of their club or fan base, adds Perry. Maybe the player isn't necessarily the big superstar or most talented to have ever come from that club, but generally they tend to be a big fan favorite. The fans saw that player as a reflection of themselves on the pitch, and quite often the players saw themselves as a reflection of the fan base as well. From Milan to Manchester United, some clubs could feature heavily here, so we've gone to one representative per team. To kick things off, though, it only feels right to include an athletic star. The only current player on the list embodies the club's values and also has his own remarkable story. Iñaki Williams would not be a legend in Balboa if it wasn't for the sacrifices made by his parents, who left Ghana in search of a better future while his mother Maria was pregnant, crossing part of the Sahara barefoot to settle in northern Spain. We had to suffer a lot, Williams told me before helping Athletic to a first Copa del Rey triumph in 40 years. Thanks to God, we are all here together and now living a really good life. Growing up an Athletic fan, Williams was the first black player to score for the club and helped his brother Nico break through too. Iñaki Williams always says, "My dream is to be able to say I spent my entire career playing for my boyhood club," adds Perry. At 31 and with more than 500 appearances for Athletic, including a La Liga record, 251 in a row, the forward looks good to deliver on that dream. Two brothers, one club, and a 40-year wait. There are plenty of worthy shouts for an older generation of stars. Jack Charlton at Leeds United and Bolton Wanderers' Nat Lofthouse among them. But with the commercialization and globalization of modern football, making one-club wonders feel increasingly rare, we've not strayed too far into the past. Apart from that, that is to include Lev Yashin, the Ballon d'Or winning goalkeeper who spent his entire career between 1950 and 1970 with Dynamo Moscow. He also played ice hockey for them. Yashin, at number 9, is also the only goalkeeper on this list, although honorable mentions go to 39-year-old Roger Akinfeev into his 23rd season with CSKA Moscow, and Brazilian Rogério Ceni, who played more than 1,000 times for São Paulo and remarkably scored 129 goals. Giuseppe Bergomi sweeps in at 8, making his Inter debut shortly after turning 16 in 1980, and remaining the club's youngest ever player. Only Javier Zanetti has more appearances than the versatile Italian defenders, 519 for the Nerazzurri. From San Siro to Southampton, where Matthew Letizler spent his time sauntering around the deli, scoring worldies and tormenting goalkeepers from the penalty spot. Mark Crossley, the only man to stop him from 48 attempts. Letizier could have moved on to bigger pastures, Manchester United, Chelsea, and Tottenham among those keen, but then he wouldn't have made this list or kept Saints in the top flight for so long. There are players who have stood on the brink of one clubmanship, only to prolong their careers elsewhere. Think Thomas Müller at Vancouver, Steven Gerrard in L.A., John Terry in the Midlands. But at number 6 is someone who committed themselves entirely to Merseyside. When Jamie Carragher was invited to receive the One Club Man Award at St. Mames, he said, "After winning the Champions League, being a One Club Man is the biggest achievement of my career." Despite all their team silverware, players value the prize as a huge honor. They think their status as a one-club player is something that's been undersung throughout the years, says Perry. One thing that also strikes me is how humble they've been, which perhaps is quite telling considering the values of the award. Carragher played under six managers during his 16-year career at Anfield. And while Carlos Puyol, coming in at number five, played under eight at Barcelona, who accepted an offer to sell the defender before he had even made his debut. Puyol refused to leave, then won the lot. It's a rare and a difficult achievement to be a one-club player at any club, not just a top club, explains Perry. Clubs are constantly pushing to improve, and transfer strategies are a huge part of that. Carragher and Puyol mentioned they know different managers sign different players to try and replace them. It was a huge challenge they had to overcome. Maintaining the level required to play in a top division football team over a sustained period comes with a lot of pressure and competition. Tony Adams at number four was part of a transition from George Graham's discipline to the progressive approach of Arsene Wenger, captaining Arsenal to league titles in three different decades. Adams, meanwhile, had to overcome alcoholism, serving 4 months in prison in 1990 for drink driving before founding the Sporting Chance Clinic in 2000. The Romford-born centre-back made 672 appearances in a Gunners shirt, his defining moment striding onto, of all people, Steve Bould's pass to score against Everton and put the icing on Arsenal's title cake in 1998. Ryan Giggs at three is unique in that 940 of his 963 games and all of his 168 goals for Manchester United came under one manager, Sir Alex Ferguson. The Welshman won 13 Premier League titles and two Champions Leagues in a career that spanned 24 seasons and during which he evolved from marauding down the wing to central midfield and eventually the dugout during a brief stint as interim boss. Maintaining the level required to play in a top division football team over a sustained period comes with a lot of pressure and competition. Tony Adams at number four was part of a transition from George Graham's discipline to the progressive approach of Arsene Wenger, captaining Arsenal to league titles in three different decades. Adams, meanwhile, had to overcome alcoholism, serving 4 months in prison in 1990 for drink driving before founding the Sporting Chance Clinic in 2000. The Romford-born centre-back made 672 appearances in a Gunners shirt, his defining moment striding onto, of all people, Steve Bould's pass to score against Everton and put the icing on Arsenal's title cake in 1999. I'm sorry I read something twice. Ryan Giggs, at three, is unique in that 940 of his 963 games and all of his 168 goals for Manchester United came under one manager, Sir Alex Ferguson. Moving to golf. Why It's Time for Rose to Come of Age at Masters by Ian Carter. To come close to matching the romance of Rory McIlroy's magical Masters, then surely the green jacket in 2026 has to go to the man beaten in the playoff 12 months ago. While McIlroy's relief and joy at finally landing the one major to elude him came pouring out on the 18th green, Justin Rose watched on, wondering what might have been. Augusta was painful, but at the same time I was proud at how I played, the 45-year-old Englishman told the BBC Sport. Rose had played some of the best final day golf ever seen at Augusta National, 10 birdies, 6 of them on an inspired back 9. He came home in 32, birdieing the last for a sparkling 66 to tie the low total of the week at 11 under par. It was the second time he had suffered playoff heartbreak at the hands of a European Ryder Cup teammate, having lost to Sergio Garcia in 2017. I learned a lot from the Sergio playoff and put it into practice, but it wasn't to be, said Rose. In the field, for this week's 90th Masters, there will be no player seeking a first Augusta crown with a better pedigree. He would be the second oldest winner after Jack Nicklaus, who 40 years ago extended his own records with a 6th win and 18th major, if the wait for a green jacket finally ends this Sunday. My game good enough to compete with the best. And why not? Despite his age, Rose remains a top 10 player who statistically played the best golf of anyone in helping Europe to a first away win since 2012 in last year's Ryder Cup. He beat a top-class field and defeated U.S. Open champion, J.J. Spaun, in a playoff in the first of the PGA Tour's end-of-season playoff events in Memphis last August. Then, in February, romped to victory by 7 shots at Torrey Pines. Getting back in the winner's circle in big events on the PGA Tour is testament that my game is still good enough to compete with the best players, Rose said. And just knowing that gives me the motivation to continue to work hard and to keep believing in myself. Rose suffered 2 missed cuts in the wake of his San Diego victory in February, but then performed well to finish in a share of 13th at last month's prestigious Players' Championship. Nothing spectacular, but solid golf in a very demanding environment. And that is textbook Rose. The 2013 U.S. Open champion is tougher than most and, despite his longevity, still relishes the fight for the biggest titles, the ones that are hardest to win. I'm pretty good at gearing up for the weeks I want to play well, and I think having that sort of experience to do that, he said. Leading into the Masters, Rose made a schedule switch, dropping his original plan to play last week's Texas Open to concentrate on readying himself for the demands of Augusta. I'd love to find a way to play well every single week, he said. But if I can find a way to hone in on the weeks that I really want to play well, that will be enough for me to chase down some of the goals I have left in my career. 10 birdies on a Sunday at Augusta was seriously amazing. Having posted runner-up finishes in each of the past 2 seasons, he was second to Xander Schauffele at the 2024 Open in Royal Troon before falling to McIlroy's playoff birdie in the Masters a year ago. The majors are his priority. There's an Open at Royal Birkdale in July, the venue where he announced himself by chipping in at the last to finish fourth as a 17-year-old amateur in 1998. But the Masters has extra resonance given his remarkable record there. He has been runner-up 3 times, having shared second place with Phil Mickelson behind Jordan Spieth in 2015. A record 5 times, including last year, he has held the first-round lead and on 9 occasions has led or jointly led the game's most glorious, glamorous tournament. No golfer is owed anything by any venue or any tournament, but Rose is as entitled as anyone to call in some Augusta favors. Last year, it was the 3-over-par third round that proved his undoing. He partnered Bryson DeChambeau, who played himself into the final pairing with McIlroy, while Rose went backwards after holding the halfway lead with opening rounds of 65 and 71. I actually played way better than Bryson that day, but his short game was great, Rose told me. He turned a 75 into a 69, and I turned 69 into 75. It was one of those days when you come off and realize you've given away too many cheap ones. I did live to rue that, for sure. I had to pick myself up. I had to change my mindset coming into Sunday. Reframe everything and not make it about the tournament, just make it about Augusta National. I had to remember how special Sunday is there, no matter what position you are in. I played with a lot of gratitude on that Sunday, which put me in a nice free mindset, which obviously led to some great golf. While McIlroy was traveling on one of golf's most dramatic roller coaster rides, Rose slotted putt after putt, especially on the inward half. 10 birdies on a Sunday at Augusta was seriously amazing golf, said Rose. Holding that birdie putt on 18 to give myself a chance, and then 2 great swings in the playoff. He was inches from making birdie in the shootout, unlucky that his ball did not tumble down the slope to the hole side in the same way as McIlroy's approach managed to do. That will provide good memories for me and a positive experience as much as it stings, Rose said. Ultimately, the moment belonged to McIlroy, but Rose won plaudits not just for his golf, but his gracious sportsmanship, embracing the victor despite the huge disappointment of yet another near miss. People were really kind to me after that, Rose said. I was just voicing how I felt. I had learned a lot from the 2017 playoff. I controlled what I felt like I could control. I made good swings. I executed under the pressure, and sometimes you can't make the ball do exactly what you want it to do. But you know if you've done a good job or not, so I think because of that I was able to be happy for Rory in the moment, and obviously to witness history. Separate yourself from your emotions for a moment. It was a cool arena to be in. This will be Rose's 21st attempt at Augusta. How fitting it would be this Sunday if he were to find a way to come of age as Masters champion. In tennis, Norrie claims first win in Monte Carlo since 2019. Britain's Cameron Norrie began his clay court season on a winning note with 6-2, 4-6, 7-6, and 7-0 victory over Serbia's Miomir Kecmanovic in the first round of the Monte Carlo Masters. After dominating the opening set, Nori, who had not won a match at the tournament since 2019, struggled in the second. He dropped serve 3 times, including in his final 2 service games. The decider proved tense, with the Briton broken by the world number 58 when serving for the match at 5-4 ahead. But in the tiebreak, it was world number 24, Nori, British number 1 again after leapfrogging Jack Draper in March, who raised his game to come through. The 30-year-old will next face a rematch with Australian world number 6, Alex de Minaur, whom he defeated on his way to the quarterfinals in Indian Wells last month. Raducanu pulls out of another tournament after illness, by Jonathan Jericho. Emma Raducanu has delayed the start of her clay court season as she continues her recovery from a viral illness, according to her representatives. The British number 1 was due to play at the Linz Open in Austria next week, but BBC Sport was told on Wednesday she has withdrawn from the WTA 500 event. It is understood Raducanu, 23, wants to focus on making a full recovery before returning to competitive action on the clay. The world number 28 started feeling unwell while playing during February's Middle East hard court swing. She competed in Indian Wells last month, but then decided to skip Miami. It has led to another period of uncertainty for Raducanu. Her career has been littered with injury and physical issues since winning the Grand Slam title in New York as a teenage qualifier. Last season, she made encouraging strides, completing a half-century of matches in a season for the first time. But it has been another stuttered start this year. The opening 3 months have seen a familiar mix, signs of progress, chastening defeats, a coaching change, and disruption caused by her health. Raducanu has played 6 tournaments this season, winning 7 of her 14 matches. 4 of those wins came in a run to the Transylvania Open Final, where she was aiming for a first title since her shock U.S. Open triumph in 2021. Raducanu hopes to return for the Madrid Open, which is the opening WTA 1000 event of the European clay court season. Raducanu's withdrawal from Linz comes a day after fellow Briton Jack Draper pulled out of the Monte Carlo Masters as he continues his cautious comeback following an arm injury. The French Open, which rounds off the clay swing, begins at the end of May. And that's all the time I have for today. I'm Mary Lee Muse for Talking Information Radio.